Welcome to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This morning, the rumor that had been circulating for months finally became reality. IBM is getting out of the chip manufacturing business. The corporation Global Foundries is taking over those operations, which include IBM's Essex plant. Business leaders and politicians gathered this morning in Burlington to explain the deal and how they think it will impact the thousands of workers at IBM and the substantial ripple effect the plant has on Vermont's economy. VPR reporter Taylor Dobbs was at the announcement, and he's here with me now. Hi, Taylor. Nice to talk with you. So can you just outline the deal for us as we know it now?
Sure. So IBM actually isn't selling the division, and it's not giving it away either. It's paying Global Foundries $1.5 billion over the course of 3 years to take the chip division off its hands. And that includes the Essex plant, as we know, and there's another plant in East Fishkill, New York. It also includes the manufacturing aspect and the commercial side selling the chips as well. And as part of the deal, Global Foundries is going to provide chips for IBM's future endeavors for the next 10 years.
So what are we to understand about the value of the Essex plant if IBM couldn't sell it, couldn't give it away, but in fact, as you said, had to pay Global Foundries to take it off its hands?
Well, that doesn't paint a good picture, but leaders in the state and also in the business community say it's actually a very valuable plant. It's gone from 8,000 to 4,000 workers in recent years, largely because the division wasn't IBM's priority. And what Governor Peter Shumlin said is that this is a win because Global Foundries' only purpose really is chip manufacturing. So that aligns very well with what the Essex plant does.
So is there a guarantee then that the Essex plant will stay in operation now that it will be owned by Global Foundries?
Right. Well, that's a big question, of course. And Governor Shumlin has indicated that the Global Foundries leadership has said, yes, they're going to stay, and they may even expand operations at the Essex facility. A big part of that is because the Essex facility is not the same as other facilities in the region that Global Foundries now owns. So Governor Shumlin says that it's going to be okay, and these jobs are going to stay in Vermont.
Is that a guarantee, or is that just an assumption at this point? You mentioned that Global Foundries has said it will continue making microchips for IBM for the next 10 years. Is it a guarantee that the Essex plant will remain in operation?
Well, Shumlin wasn't totally clear on that point, but it sounded as though they had indicated that they're staying, but there was nothing on paper, nothing formal that says these jobs are definitely going to stay in Vermont.
And have you heard from Global Foundries executives yourself yet? Have they made statements today?
No, they came out with a press release announcing the deal, but they definitely are touting this as a victory for them. They're getting this whole company and, of course, $1.5 billion. IBM apparently is suffering here because we saw the stock market open and IBM was way down this morning. So people are seeing this as kind of a loss for IBM, of course, because they're having to give away a bunch of assets as well as the money involved.
You know, the stock was down this morning. You've been tweeting about that. You've been tweeting about the announcement as you've been following it this morning. But this didn't come really as a surprise. I mean, as we said, this has been rumored for months, and massive deals like this certainly don't go through overnight. So can you also now explain the timeline for Global Foundries to actually take over the Essex plant?
Sure. Well, things are starting right away. Global Foundries is in Vermont today. They're meeting with employees at the Essex plant. And IBM is a publicly traded company, so they're going to have to wait for federal approval for this deal to go through. No one's expecting there to be any bumps in that, but that still takes months. So nothing will be final until about 2015, is what everyone's saying.
Taylor, politicians have worked pretty hard over the last decade to keep IBM happy here in Vermont. What kind of courtship should we expect now as Global Foundries begins to set up shop here?
Well, that work to keep whoever owns that plant happy is going to definitely continue. Shumlin has already put together the beginnings of a transition team that's going to help Global Foundries come into the state and going to try to make everything as smooth as possible in terms of keeping those jobs here and making it easy for them to run that plant. And people may also remember that the legislature approved $4.5 million this year to help keep those IBM jobs in the state. And now that money has not yet been deployed, but it could be used as part of this effort to make things a little smoother for Global Foundries.
Taylor Dobbs, are you hearing anything yet from IBM workers themselves about how they're feeling?
No, but Frank Coffey of the Greater Burlington Industrial Corporation this morning said that the uncertainty at the IBM plant, just there were all these rumors going around for the past few years, and there have been a lot of cuts. So the uncertainty has really been wearing on workers there. And now that this deal has been announced and GlobalFoundries has given some assurance that the jobs will remain, I would guess that's a pretty big breath of fresh air for those workers.
You're going to continue following this story. What's up next for you in looking at this? What other questions do you have?
Well, there's some sort of mystery around GlobalFoundries because they are not a publicly traded company. So a lot of the things that IBM routinely has to disclose can be kept private by GlobalFoundries. The government of Abu Dhabi has a pretty big stake in the company, but it is also based in California. So
the company is GlobalFoundries.
The company is based there, yes. So their headquarters is there. So it's a U.S.-operated company, but they pitch themselves as the first truly global chip business. So that will open up a whole lot of interesting doors in terms of Vermont's Essex Junction plant being a part of this global network.
And that's also because IBM has some fingers into U.S. military contracts.
Yes. And so actually, Senator Leahy has been working on that a lot. And John Tracy from his office was at today's press conference about that. And he said the sale would likely prompt a DOD review just because it's new ownership and they have to get to know this new company and is it trustworthy and can they count on chips coming from them in the future. But he said that Senator Leahy is going to do everything he can to keep the status quo going in terms of this facility producing chips for the Department of Defense.
That's VPR's Taylor Dobbs. Taylor, thank you for updating us today.
Pleasure to be here.
You can follow our coverage of the IBM deal this afternoon at VPR.net this evening on All Things Considered. And join us tomorrow on Vermont Edition when we're going to be taking a much deeper look at what the sale of IBM means for Vermont. You're listening to Vermont Edition. Coming up, we're going to talk about something called a benefit corporation or a B corporation. There are actually two distinctions, but it's a way for businesses to do business differently, to have something other than just money as the bottom line. We're going to talk about that. And if you have questions about B Corps, benefit corporations, if you maybe work at one, there are over 20 of them in Vermont, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. 1-800-639-2211, or send a note about what it means to work for a benefit corporation to Vermont Edition at VPR.net. That's coming up next here on Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There are a lot of nonprofit companies out there that work to make the world a better place, and there are a lot of for-profit companies where profit is the main motivation. Certainly for shareholders, the responsibility of many for-profit companies is to make the best business deals possible and to post a healthy return. But for for-profit companies that want to incorporate a social mission along with making money, some new designations have cropped up to help them survive in the cutthroat world of business takeovers and to help them gain visibility, navigate with more transparency, and prove their value to investors, clients, and customers. We're talking about B corporations and benefit corporations. Those are two different things, as it turns out, and we'll get into the distinctions in a moment. But suffice it to say, these labels and what's behind them allow companies to declare that money is not their sole goal. Behaving in an ethical way to their employees, to the environment, and towards their communities, as well as doing business in a more transparent manner, are all critical to the mission. This way of doing business is catching on, and we're going to explore it today with Tom Payne, Director of Marketing for the King Arthur Flour Company in Norwich, and Ashley Orgain, Manager of Corporate Consciousness at Seventh Generation in Burlington. Ashley, Tom, welcome to Vermont Edition. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having us today.
All right. So before we get into a lot of details about specific designations and the legal language and the differences between one label and another, can you just tell me in simple words what it means to be a benefit corporation and to do business differently? Ashley, let's start with you.
Great. Thank you. I'd say in the simplest of terms, it is like what fair trade is to coffee, and it's what like LEED is to green buildings. It essentially is a holistic way to measure a business's impact and really help them make progress against being a more sustainable business on a variety of different levels, looking at workers, looking at community, looking at the environment, and looking at governance.
And why can't you do all of that while making the most money possible?
Well, I think the model is different than your typical corporate model because it doesn't just look at shareholders, it looks at stakeholders. So it's looking at making an impact on a variety of different individuals and organizations, including the environment.
Tom Payne, you next. What do you think? Can you expand on that?
Yeah, I would reiterate what Ashley said. I do believe it's possible to be profitable as a benefit corporation or a B Corp, But it's taking into account all of the stakeholders. You know, that's your employees. Those, it could even be your supply chain, your customers. It's more than just making a profit at the end of the day.
How is that different than other companies? And don't a lot of companies already think about their employees, for example, or try to do business in a way that's sustainable for the environment without trying to label themselves as something different?
I think they do. I think the distinction here, in particular as a B Corp, is that there's a third party, a neutral third party, who's evaluating you. So a lot of companies have a lot of marketing messages that talk about what great things they're doing. But to have a third party score, you know, evaluate you and give you a scorecard, just is a level of transparency and openness that you don't get unless there's somebody looking and checking the facts.
All right. Well, we're going to talk about that. We're going to dive now into what it actually means to have somebody designating you a B Corp or to have the state designation of a benefit corporation. And I want to invite listeners into the conversation as well. You may work for a benefit corporation. There are quite a few of them in the state of Vermont. And if you do and you want to tell us what you think it means for your company's bottom line or what it makes a difference for you as a worker, do you notice something different about the company that you work for now versus perhaps other places that you've worked? You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Or maybe you have a question for one of our guests today about what it actually means for them, how this all works. You can ask a couple of representatives from Vermont companies that have gone this route. Again, our number is 1-800-639-2211. Okay, so Tom Paine, King Arthur Flour, is both a benefit corporation and a B Corp, and this can get a little bit confusing, so let's just take this apart for a minute. There's a state designation. Benefit corporations get a certain level of protection in business dealings. For example, if there was a hostile takeover bid because of the way they do business. Can you explain what kind of protection you have?
Right. The benefit corporation designation, that's a legal status. So the state recognizes us as a benefit corporation. That means we've written into our articles of incorporation that we are a benefit corporation and that we take into account all stakeholders, not simply profit or the owners of the company. So for instance, if there were, say, a hostile takeover bid, we could evaluate the offer based not only on a share price that they're offering, but also whether they're willing to maintain the corporate culture and the values and the mission of the company.
And that's the difference, that in if you didn't have this state designation, you might not be able to take that into account, those other factors into account in the offer?
That's right. I mean, this gives you legal protection. It gives the trustees of the company, you know, they have a fiduciary responsibility to evaluate offers that may be made, and this gives them some level of protection, if you will, against kind of unwanted advances by perhaps a potential buyer who's not interested in maintaining the mission of the company.
Okay, so that's a benefit corporation, and there are 27 states that have legal definitions of benefit corporations. Vermont is one of them. Ashley Orgain, then there's B Corporation. So B, of course, standing for benefit, but different than what's called a benefit corporation. So can you explain what a B Corp is?
That is correct. Sure. So Seventh Generation was a founding member of the B Corp movement back in 2008, and the legislation in Vermont wasn't passed to 2011. So as a B Corporation, a founding member, we first have to meet rigorous performance requirements. We talked a little bit earlier about the impact assessment that measures benefit B Corporations against governance, workers, environment, and community. Once you've done that, you have to choose the legal path you're going to take. The legal path that Seventh Generation chose to take was actually to include B Corp status in our bylaws. And once we've done that, then we sign an article of Declaration of Interdependence, which all B Corporations have to sign.
And what does that mean, Declaration of Interdependence?
It's essentially aligning to the fact that we all are interconnected, that business, the environment, the community that which we live and work and operate in are interconnected, and we have a responsibility to take care of those stakeholders.
And what does it mean to have to be able to get this certification? You said you had to be able to – you kind of have to clear certain hurdles, and you actually get a score. So what does that mean?
That's correct. So you're measured, again, in those four different areas. You have to reach a score of 80 or above in those four areas out of 200. And with that, then – you're identified as a company that's doing good in those areas, that you're having a positive impact.
And again, the areas are in the environment, your own workers, transparency, and community. Right?
It's governance. You're almost there. Governance and community.
So what 81 out of 200 sounds like a failing grade. So why is that a passing grade to only get 81? I mean, if you're just hearing that, it sounds like 81, that's got to be a piece of cake.
I know that Tom can probably say these aren't easy questions to answer. I mean, they dive deep into a company's principles and practices and how you operate. So 80 is a good score. You're looking at also other businesses that are trying to achieve sustainability, and that's generally where they net out around 80. B Corp is going that much farther.
What's seventh generation score?
We right now are 116. We're recertifying in the end of October, and we're hoping to achieve 130 status.
And would that put you ahead of a lot of companies? If 80 is a tough score to actually hit, 130 would be pretty good.
130 would be great for us, yes. I think we'd be falling in line with a lot of our industry peers. We know we can go much further, so we aspire to achieve a higher grade than that.
We're talking today about benefit corporations and B corporations, learning a little bit more about what that means and how these companies in Vermont who have those distinctions do business. And again, listeners, if you have a question, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Dave's on the line with us from St. Johnsbury. Hi, Dave. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm interested in distinguishing these from nonprofits. It has been my impression that often nonprofits appear to be charitable organizations, but in fact, they are ways of funneling excessively high salaries to their officers. And I just wonder what your reaction is to that.
Dave, thanks for the call. Tom Payne, we'll go to you first on that. I mean, again, another distinction here, the distinction between a benefit corporation or a B Corp and a nonprofit, and Dave's thoughts on that.
Sure. Well, I can speak only for King Arthur Flour. We are, in fact, a for-profit company. We're an employee-owned company, so the employees are the ones who gain in that profit. And we're also a mission-driven company. So I think it was an outgrowth of our employee ownership culture that made us look to become a B Corp and ultimately a benefit corporation, because we believe our mission is more than simply enriching ourselves. We also want to enrich our community. So it is possible there's peaceful coexistence there. In fact, I wouldn't even call it peaceful coexistence. I mean, that's part of our success, is having that kind of a culture.
I don't know if this is what Dave was going towards at all, but does it feel a little bit more honest to be saying, you know, profit is a part of this, profit is a part of it, and we do want our employees and our leadership team to make the money that they are going into business to make, but then there are these other parts. I mean, is there a little bit of transparency in that sense, Tom?
Absolutely. It is about transparency. Certainly for your customers to be able to look at you and say, I want my money to go to this company because I believe they're doing something positive for the world, for their communities, and it makes them feel a little bit better about that purchase. And also because of the transparency, because of the B Corp scorecard and the report that we have to provide to the state as a benefit corporation, people can open those documents up, public documents, and see what it is that we are doing, or even on the reverse side, where we're falling short. That's the nice thing about the transparency is it has stimulated us to look to improve our score every year. We look at the areas where we're maybe not performing as well, and we set our own internal goals to say, we want to improve that community score. We want to improve that environment score.
And what is your score for King Arthur Flour, Tom?
Our current score is 108, which, is – Ashley mentioned, it's difficult even to reach 80. So we're very happy to be at 108, but we're not satisfied with that. We've increased our score every year since we started taking the B impact assessment, and we set a goal every year to keep improving.
Sounds like these are companies with a little bit of internal competition issues too going on. You want to beat your score. Ashley, what are your thoughts on what Dave was saying here? I mean, this isn't to say that the CEOs of B corporations aren't going to be getting rich. They may well be getting rich while doing this kind of business.
They could. I think for us, being a profitable company allows us to invest more into being a good company. So it allows us to drive dollars towards the good that we want to do in the world. We're very much more like a social enterprise than your typical corporation. So for us to be able to fund the programs, like auditing our suppliers and giving good benefits to our employees, or investing in our community, investing in the Sustainability Academy, one of our neighbors just in the Burlington area, we do need to achieve some profitable goals. And that profit allows us to do that good work.
Tom Payne, we were talking a moment ago about the distinction between benefit corporations and B corporations, and how benefit corporation is a state designation. It allows you some legal protection. B Corp is a certified, you get certified by a company called B Labs. You are both. And one of the ways to get the state designation is you have to be certified through a third party that says, yes, you are doing these things that we've been talking about and you are being monitored. So how does that work to get both? Why did you want to go that route?
Well, you know, one came before the other. As Ashley mentioned, we were a founding B Corp as well in 2008, and there was not a legal option. There was no benefit corporation legislation in the state of Vermont at the time. And it became – when it became possible, we applied for that designation, and it just made a lot of sense to have B Lab be the certifier. We were already getting certified as a B Corp, so the B Lab certification is an acceptable form for the state of Vermont, and it's, you know, it's a model that we're familiar with and that worked for us. So that was why we chose to do both.
Do you know of any other entity that does certify B corporations, benefit corporations?
I'm not aware of any personally. I don't know. Ashley, maybe she is.
To my knowledge, it's just B Lab.
And Ashley, Seventh Generation decided not to get the state designation, not to become a benefit corporation by state law. Why not? I mean, you mentioned that you wrote things into the Seventh Generation bylaws that say we are a B corporation, here's our mission, but why not get that state protection?
So great question. I think the reason really comes down to the fact that we feel that our bylaws are a bit more rigorous than the state legislation. We have five or all of our board members who are really committed to being held responsible for those stakeholders and the four different categories that we're measured against, versus the state requiring just one board member to be held responsible for being a B corporation.
And you believe your bylaws would protect you in the event of a hostile takeover?
I mean, I know our board believes that, yes.
That sounds not totally convinced.
You know, I am pretty confident. With a company that has been mission-driven since day one, we are very committed to having a positive impact in the world, and we look at this as the highest measurement for that impact.
Are there certain things in the state designation that might actually limit the company? I mean, is there anything else besides this protection, or are there rules to get that state protection that might not be appealing to either Seventh Generation or another company? I mean, why not just have both?
We haven't identified those yet, so I would say no, and that's not a hurdle we've actually chosen to tackle yet.
We're talking today about benefit corporations and B Corps. We're talking with a couple of representatives from Vermont companies that have gone this route that say, look, we have a social mission. We have a bottom line that incorporates more than just money. And we're doing certain things to make sure that we achieve those. And we are getting certification through B Lab. Listeners, if you have a question about how this works, or if you want to ask them a direct question about what it's like to do this kind of business, or maybe you work for one of the more than 20 B Corps in Vermont, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also find us on social media at Vermont Edition. More coming up. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. We're learning about benefit corporations and B Corps today with Tom Payne, Director of Marketing for King Arthur Flour Company, based in Norwich, and Ashley Orgain, Manager of Corporate Consciousness at Seventh Generation, based in Burlington. We're finding out what the benefits are for benefit corporations, for their employees, and for those who might want to do business with these types of companies. If you have a question about B corporations or benefit corporations, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Let's go to Kelly, who's calling in from Hanover, New Hampshire. Hi, Kelly. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. First, I want to commend all of you on your kind of hybrid approach to your business model. I think it's really wonderful and something that might be able to help out the economy overall in the future. My question is kind of twofold. Have these companies had a chance or time to measure company morale and how this, and second question is, do each of these companies have wellness departments?
Ooh, interesting question.
Standards of excellence.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Tom Payne, you first.
Sure. I think we're maybe a little bit of a special case because we've been an employee-owned company since 1996. We've had this sort of ownership culture and a social mission bent to our business model for a long time. I would say that we need to do more internally to educate our own employees about what it means to be a B Corp and a benefit corporation because, as you mentioned at the start of the show, they are confusing. And I think we need to do a little bit better on that regard. But we definitely have a very kind of active ownership culture here. We have monthly town meetings that are completely open. We share the financials. People can stand up and ask any question of anybody in the company. And we do that. We have some really, really robust conversations. And we do have a wellness team at this company, and they're very active. There are lots of opportunities for employees to improve their physical and mental well-being. And those, I believe those programs also help us with our B Corp score.
Ashley Orgain, what about for Seventh Generation?
Sure. We don't have a formal wellness department. What we have is a cross-functional team that helps on integrating sustainability into our community. And that team runs module programs throughout the year that focus on wellness. They focus on environmental impact. And they also focus on financial savings. So nothing formal, but we work on integrating those principles in that program. As far as measuring morale, we don't do anything formal either. But I'd say anecdotally, we're able to tell just through the inspiration that all employees were able to leave the Flynn Theater with just this last week after we had the B Corp Champions Retreat here. We had probably over 75% of our company involved in the Champions Retreat and walking out fairly wide-eyed and inspired about being part of this movement.
And that was a big conference for B Corporations all over the country to come together and have this B Corp Champions Retreat.
All over the world, actually, yes. We had 14 countries represented, and we had over 350 B Corps here in Vermont.
Ashley, do you find that having this designation, B Corp, is a way to also recruit workers? I mean, does it make a difference when you're trying to get good staff members in to be able to say, to look to this score and to this designation and say, look, we're a B Corp?
Most definitely. I would say the workforce of today is looking for their company to provide them not only a stable salary, but also the opportunity to do something good. And you see the workforce today looking for different criteria that measures against that. And B Corporation is definitely one of them.
Don's calling in from Brattleboro. Hi, Don. You're on the air. Oh, Don is not on the air. Well, you know, we've been talking with representatives from a couple of local companies here, Seventh Generation, King Arthur Flour Company, that have gone this route. But we want to also look today at, is this a sustainable business model, a growing one? How much of this is about finding a niche and grabbing consumers with a good story? And where is the movement going? So to talk a little bit about that, we've called up Eric Ortz. He's a professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. Hi, Professor Ortz. Nice to talk with you.
Hello. Thanks for calling.
Quick question first. Can publicly traded companies be benefit corporations?
Well, that doesn't seem to be there. I don't believe there are very many that have taken that course yet. So one of the reasons, I think, is that you would need some changes in the securities listing requirements and maybe the securities laws to expand the interests of companies. Now, I don't think there's anything preventing them from doing so, but I don't know of any cases so far. The leading cases that I've heard about are mostly privately held companies.
So the businesses that we're seeing on the Dow and the NASDAQ, those are not likely to be B corporations.
Well, at least not quite yet. I mean, I think there is there is a movement that's growing in this field, and as you may have already covered, about 27 states have now adopted benefit corporation statutes, which, in general, at least from the corporate law side, would allow large firms to opt in to be benefit corporations. So we just haven't seen a movement. We haven't yet seen a movement in that direction. And you would probably need to have a little bit of a cultural shift and then also some legal shifts at the level of the courts and, as I mentioned, the federal securities laws, before you saw this take off in the publicly traded companies.
So, Professor Ortz, what are you seeing here in terms of investment in these companies? As we just discussed, it's not likely that the big publicly traded companies are taking up this designation, and there may be some changes that are needed. But are other types of investors shying away from these types of companies because money isn't the bottom line, or is it attracting a certain type of investor?
Well, that's a good question. I don't know if we have good empirical work quite yet. I think it's an area ripe for academic study about where some financing is coming for these companies. But there's a lot of financing that's available outside of the normal securities markets or the regular securities markets. If you have a hot idea that is possible to attract a venture capitalist, then that might be a possible venue. Now, a lot of times, though, the venture capitalists, at least the types in Silicon Valley that most people hear about, are looking for some sort of – they're mostly looking for a return, namely financial return. I think there are a few funds now that are starting to look at combining the two, so that if you have a really good idea that it's going to combine a sustainability objective, for example, with a financial profit objective, that might attract some financing. But you have to go outside the usual route. One other area that's interesting, I think, and might be even revolutionary, is the crowdsourcing option. So what that means is if you have a new product, for example, and I just bought a pair of sunglasses this way, where you have a new idea, you want to have a sustainable pair of a new sustainable product, and then you crowdsource the funding for that on something like Kickstarter or some of those other financing techniques. So you see that happening a little bit, and that might actually, if that could be expanded, that could be revolutionary, where you'd have a lot of where you'd open up the capital investing to a lot more people. But I think that something like that is needed to get the to get this to the next level, where you have significant amounts of financing that would be going into these firms, and then that would help to grow the phenomenon.
Well, on that note, Eric Ortz, what about this movement? I mean, you say that more is needed to take it to the next level, but do you see this as a movement that's catching on?
Well, I think a big signal for me that this was actually going to be significant was that last summer the state of Delaware, which is the state that almost I think over half of the Fortune 500 are incorporated in Delaware, and it's known as the central corporate law state in the United States, Delaware adopted a benefit corporation statute. So when Delaware did that, you also have them in other major states like California, New York, Florida, et cetera. Then that starts to open up it seems like it's becoming a standard option for a firm to select. So I think in that respect, you see legal change. And whether this really is going to start to mean have larger change than that, I think you already see a growing number of companies, and you've had a few examples on the program of companies who are doing this and doing this successfully. Patagonia comes to mind as another leading example. It was the first benefit corporation to sign up in California. And so there are some successful cases. Now, whether this really is going to have legs depends on whether consumers and others really support it. So if you are doing, if you have a double objective and you are, and let's just take Patagonia, for example, you are focusing on environmentally friendly products. You're putting a lot of focus on that. But it's also true that in that case, at least, the cost is slightly higher. So it's higher quality, perhaps, and durability, but it's also going to be a premium to the market of other cheaper products that don't worry about the environmental impact as much, et cetera. So the question really is then whether consumers will also get behind this. And I think that there's a good chance that this generation, in particular, the younger generation, that is starting to think about sustainability kinds of issues more than they had. But that's speculative on my part to some extent, and maybe and you have to watch out for wishful thinking here, as my finance colleagues would remind me.
Well, you know, speaking of having something that's more quantifiable, and I don't know if there's a way to do this, but before we let you go, I just wanted to ask you, Eric Ortz, is there a way to quantify the profits versus the gains, the profits that might be lost in this kind of business model if money is in the bottom line versus the gains? And there's so many variables. I mean, you look at maybe the margins are smaller if the product is being sold at a premium. But is there any way to quantify what impact this has on the economy?
Well, it's really a very a lot of people have attempted to look empirically at the question of whether it pays to be good, if you would. And there's a lot of research, unfortunately, that's what I would call wishful thinking research, because they want to find that that works that way. And so so that's not the way to do good research. But it's very difficult to tease this out. And one of the reasons is that we have pretty good metrics, although you know, they're different metrics, but they're pretty good metrics about measuring whether a company is doing well or poorly in terms of profits and its financial success. If you look at this other, if you look at other measures, it's not that easy to figure out whether a company is actually doing good or what is the progress. Now, I think there's a lot of progress that's being made on this by some of the bigger companies are measuring their climate change. Their greenhouse gas emissions, for example. They're measuring their water use and trying to get their water use down. They're trying to decrease their energy usage. So a lot of big companies are doing that. Now, partly they're doing that for financial reasons and for strategic reasons. But I think also you're starting to get some ways in which you can measure this. But it's actually kind of difficult to measure how well you're doing, right? And so the concern that some have is that that a company will say it's doing these good things, but then how do you really know, and how do you really figure out whether how that relates to the financial picture? So you ask a good question. I'm sorry I can't give you a good answer, but it's because it's really difficult to measure that sort of thing.
Well, that's kind of an interesting point, you know, that it is so difficult to measure, and certainly part of what having certification and monitoring is all about. Eric Ortz, professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania, thank you so much for talking with us today. I really appreciate your perspective.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Professor Ortz is also the author of Business Persons, A Legal Theory of the Firm. We're talking about what it means legally, ethically, and in terms of marketability to be a benefit corporation or a B Corp. Two different things, but the basic gist is that these are companies that have a mission beyond making money. And we're talking today with Ashley Orgain, the manager of corporate consciousness at Seventh Generation, and Tom Payne, who's the director of marketing for the King Arthur Flower Company. You know, just there at the end, talking with Professor Ortz, Ashley, we were looking at, you know, how do you monitor how well a company is doing and what good a company is doing. So can you talk a little bit about how that's done through B Labs? I mean, you're trying to get a score to let you know exactly how you're faring on these charts of the four things that the company is supposed to be making sure that you're working towards. But how do you let people know whether you're doing good?
Well, Seventh Generation has been long committed to the transparency. So we, on an annual basis, actually do a sustainability report that talks about the goals that we have towards measuring our impact towards 2020 on sustainability. And what we communicate to our broad group of stakeholders, including consumers, is, are we meeting those goals? If we're not, what's our plan to close that gap and actually make that good on the promise that we've committed to them? So we communicate annually through this sustainability report, but then also what you can find on the site that B-Lab has put together is Seventh Generation Score and how we measure up against those four categories. So consumers can go in, or all stakeholders can go in, and they can see how Seventh Generation is performing, where we're falling short, and then they can look at this sustainability report to identify how we're closing that gap.
And how do you find this as a marketing tool, as a way of doing business? And because, I mean, you are a business. You're trying to make a profit, and you're trying to sustain a business. So part of it must be marketing this designation and the company's mission to consumers to try to get them to buy the products, because they want to buy into the mission as well as getting the product.
Well, it's interesting. Our co-founder, Jeffrey Hollander, actually adopted this and really started the movement because of widespread greenwashing. And we saw this as the most
comprehensive way to measure against sustainability. So we have long said that we measure what matters, and we use B Corp to do that. And we communicate it in a lot of our social media. We communicate it online. We engage in that conversation when asked, and we make sure that it's understood that we have this rigorous set of standards that we are working to achieve.
What about for King Arthur Flour, Tom? Is it the same thing? I mean, do you try to market this part of your business to consumers who are buying the products?
We haven't really actively marketed it. In fact, when I was at the Bee Champions retreat last week, we were asked to make a series of commitments, and one of the things I committed to is talking about it more. You know, I think King Arthur Flour, unlike, say, Seventh Generation, which perhaps, you know, from its inception was really a company with a mission, King Arthur Flour wasn't. And people have bought our products because of the quality and because of the, you know, the things that make King Arthur great are great expertise and the products that we have and the service that we have, all these things. And I think that's why most people purchase our products. These days, when people find out we're a B Corp or a certified B Corp or a B corporate benefit corporation, they kind of say, oh, that's cool. That's great. That makes me feel even better about this purchase. So we need to do a little bit better job, I think, about telling people that we're a B Corp.
You're also trying to tell people how to become a B Corp or be sort of evangelists for this movement. Ashley Orgain mentioned the retreat last week in Burlington for B Corps, and they were actively asked to recruit other organizations. So, Tom, just quickly, how do you plan to do that or why?
Well, we're hosting a Be a Better Business seminar, if you will, or open house on November 24th, and we're going to be inviting companies in the area who are interested and curious to come down here to Norwich and to learn. We'll have a panel of some local or regional B Corps, and we'll be talking about the movement, and they'll be able to take a real quick assessment, not an extensive one like you do when you get certified, but just a quick one to kind of let business leaders get a read on where would I fall, how would I score, and is this something for me?
And Ashley Orgain, this is something you believe in too? You think other companies should do it?
Oh, most definitely, yes. And we have committed, like other B Corps at the Champions Retreat, to recruiting 5 new members by the end of the year. And so we're actually exploring the quick impact assessment that Tom mentioned in our supply chain this year.
All right, that's Ashley Orgain. She's the manager of corporate consciousness at Seventh Generation. Tom Payne is director of marketing for the King Arthur Flour Company in Norwich, and they've been helping us to understand better the designations B Corp and Benefit Corporation today. Thank you both very much for being on the program. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jane.
Thank you.
On Halloween night, front porches across Vermont will be illuminated by the glow of hand-carved jack-o'-lanterns. Some will sport a classic spooky grin, while others might be a bit more intricate. Carving jack-o'-lanterns that will catch the eye of your neighborhood trick-or-treaters, perhaps just enough to prevent them from smashing your handiwork, is yet another Halloween tradition. We spoke with Joe Weaver, who owns Red Barn Gardens on Route 2 in Williston with his wife Carolyn. He gave us some tips on what makes a pumpkin ideal for carving.
17 pounds. That's our average weight for a pumpkin, actually. Our patch is out in the back. It's about an acre, and we left a number of very small to very large, and we do hay rides and stuff to have people pick out the ones. Some people think that it has to come from you know, like cut right off the vine to be perfect, but that's not necessarily true. But hey, if they want to do it and they want to have fun, that is a great thing. First of all, there's many varieties of pumpkins for jack-o'-lanterns. The one that we grow the most of, we have about 4 or 5, but the one that we tend to think are the best are they're called Howden, and they're the ones that are a little bit taller than they are wide, and they make a lot of people think the best face for a pumpkin because you get a lot of palate to carve from. We do like little itty-bitty pipe pumpkins. You don't necessarily need to carve, but they're just cute and adorable. There are little gourds that are even smaller, little Jack B. Littles that are half a pound or whatever. Again, cute. You don't really necessarily carve them, but the kids kind of flock to them because they're really a nice size for kids. We didn't actually grow any this year, but in the past we have grown a couple of things. Like they're either called Big Maxes. Those are the ones that are really large ones that you might see at the fair. Not necessarily for carving. If you get some, we've gotten some 100 and some odd pounds big. You know, we do them just to have for decorations. this is probably not a Howden. This is probably Racer or, you know, one of the other varieties. That's kind of the classic Charlie Brown Great Pumpkin pumpkin, because it's, you know, got that nice big, you can make the big smile on it or whatever. If I had 10 different people here, they were going to probably decide on 10 different ones. But that's the whole beauty of, I think, of picking out a pumpkin. If there's enough of them out there, there's always one with your name on it. So that's always the big challenge.
That was Joe Weaver, owner of Red Barn Gardens in Williston, giving us some tips on the perfect pumpkin for carving. Our intern, Erin Lucy, produced that story. And that'll do it for today. Recapping the news we heard at the top of the show, IBM is offloading its Essex chip manufacturing plant to GlobalFoundries. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at what the IBM deal means for the operations and workers of that plant and for Vermont's economy. If you work at IBM, let us know how you're feeling. Email vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Erin Lucy. Mary Williams directed the program. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.